White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, listeners, to the International Jew Study Hour on October 4th, 2012. I am Carolyn Yeager with my co-host, Hadding Scott.
Hello.
Tonight, hi, Hadding. Tonight, we're going to complete the final part of Chapter 12 that we began last week, are we not? And it is titled, Jewish Protocols Claim Partial Fulfillment. We will finish this, and then we'll begin Chapter 13. I got the wrong thing here. Chapter 13 is called, what is Chapter 13, Hadding?
Dividing Gentile society or something to that effect.
It's bringing in ideas. If I move down here, I'll find it. Sorry, folks. Jewish plan to split society by ideas. Yeah.
There you go.
You said it. The ideas is real important. That's a great chapter, too, I think. This one is good, too. So we stopped. And I was, last week I started reading the protocol, being the protocol voice, and but we stopped at here. And if you want to start a little bit before where we stopped, or we really should tell a little bit. Well, you know, we were talking away, and all of a sudden the show was starting, and I wasn't, kind of got caught unawares here. But this... this was talking a lot about the luxuries that they have, all the things that the Jewish world plan has already instigated amongst the Gentiles. And part of this that they were, I think we still have this coming up, is the luxuries and the trinkets, the cheap luxuries, and all the stuff that they get us to pay attention to, which, according to Ford, who was quite a... I think he's very
admirable. Ascetic, or he lived a Spartan life.
Yeah, he didn't like all this frivolity and waste and partying, drinking, all that stuff. He was a very, very straight-laced fellow and serious. And so, it's kind of funny when you read how they're writing about that. Now, before that, it was just, like how we were being... how they say they're going to mislead and stupefy the Gentiles, and the chapter is showing how they have succeeded at that. So that's where we left off, and where we're going to pick up.
Alrighty. Jewish liberties are the best safeguarded in the United States. Gentiles take their chance with public matters, but every Jewish community is surrounded by special protectors who gain special recognition by various devices, political and business threats not the least of them. No public-spirited Gentiles are welcomed to the task of regulating the lives of Jewish children. The Jewish community in every city is all-sufficient in itself, as far as such activities go. The most secret of all parochial schools are the Jewish schools, whose very locations are not all known to the officials of large cities.
Well, now I got to break in right there already, because I think that was really interesting that already in 1920, when they were starting their schools, and this was already something that they knew, that some people knew, that there are a lot of Jewish schools. They didn't even want anybody to know about them. And in large cities, they get away with everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Jew is almost anxious in his efforts to mold the Gentile mind. He insists on being permitted to tell the Gentile what to think, especially about the Jew. He is not averse to influencing general Gentile thought in a manner which, though it come about by wide circles, works ultimately into the Jewish scheme of things. The anxiety and the insistence, so well known to all who have observed them, are only reflections of the Jew's conviction that his is the superior race and is capable of directing the inferior race, of which there is but one, including the whole non-Jewish world. Every influence that leads to lightness and looseness in Gentile youth today heads up in a Jewish source. Did the young people of the world devise the sports clothes, which have had so deleterious an effect on the youth of the times that every publicist has thought it worthy of mention? Those styles come out of Jewish clothing concerns, where certainly art is not the rule, nor moral influence the main consideration. The moving picture is an interesting development of photography allied with the show business, but whose is the responsibility for its development along such lines as make it a menace to the minds of millions, so serious a menace that it has not escaped observation and condemnation everywhere? Who are the masters of musical jazz in the world? Who direct all the cheap jewelry houses, the bridgehead show parks, the Coney Islands, the centers of nervous thrills and looseness? It is possible to take the showy young man and woman of trivial outlook and loose sense of responsibility and tag them outwardly and inwardly, from their clothing and ornaments to their hectic ideas and hopes, with the same tag, made, introduced, and exploited by a Jew.
Well, they're coming very strong there. That's very strong.
It almost sounds hysterical by current standards.
Yes, I mean, that, you know, compare that to this stuff seems innocent to us now. And we look back to the 1920s and we think, oh, what great times. We look back to the 1950s and think, oh, wow, that was great in America then. We were all white, you know, but they were seeing the way things were changing and the kind of cheap stuff that was coming along. You know, of course, I grew up thinking Coney Island was a place I'd like to go to. And I loved amusement parks as a kid, but they really are terrible. They're awful. They're full of lies, and they just con people right and left.
Well,
I get kind of strict. I'd kind of like to create a world like Henry Ford would have it. It would be better than what we have. See, I don't care anymore. I've gotten over all that stuff.
Well, instead of going to Coney Island, you can you can go to a barn dance and dance to the music of the Devil's Box. The violin. Anyway.
Well, he was all for fiddling and dance and social.
Yeah, well,
dancing,
some people like said that was immoral too.
Well, that was some of those really,
because you know, you can
Christians.
Bend notes with the violin, and that's not.
Yeah, well,
that's
some
not
of
godly
those people,
music.
That some of those Christian groups were really really extreme, but he wasn't like that. No, I hope not.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I'm sure he's onto something with some of these criticisms, but in retrospect, some of these look a little excessive.
Well, I don't know. The problem is
roller coasters as the cause of immorality. I'm not sure about that.
Well, I don't know if it's roller coasters. It's all that sideshow stuff.
Oh, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. There is, therefore, something most sinister in the light which events cast upon that paragraph.
We have misled, stupefied, and demoralized the youth of the Gentiles by means of education in principles and theories, patently false to us, but which we have inspired.
Principles and theories do not necessarily imply lofty or even modest intellectual qualities. The youngster who spends his noon hours and evenings at the movies is getting his principles and theories, just as the more intellectual youngster from a higher grade of society who listens to a Jewish liberal expound sex liberty and the control of population is getting his. The looseness which inheres in these principles and theories does not emanate from the Gentile home, or the Gentile church, or from any line of money-making which is filled principally with Gentiles, but from theories, movements, and lines of money-making mostly fancied by Jews. This line of accusation could be run much deeper, but it is preferred to restrict it to what is observable by decent eyes everywhere.
Well, and, he uses the word looseness.
Yeah.
You know, that's a key word in here, that trying to get everybody to be looser and not so uptight about the rules. I'm sure Henry Ford didn't have any other woman in his life except his wife when he married her, and that made a man anxious to get married when they didn't have sex outside of marriage, even the men. Good upstanding Christian men like he was such. You know, I admire that kind of a person. Now, of course, that one time when I was younger, I would have made fun of it. So there, it's all a matter of age. Okay,
and that,
sorry.
Are we ready?
Yeah.
And that the youth of the Gentiles are the principal victims and not the youth of the Jews is also observable. While a certain percentage of Jewish youth itself is overcome by this social poison, the percentage is almost nothing compared with the results among the youth of the Gentiles. It is a significant fact that Jews who link this process of enervation of Gentiles with large profits are not themselves, nor are their sons and daughters, the victims of this enervation. Jewish youth comes through more proudly and more cleanly than the mass of Gentile youth.
So he's saying, you know, people can't figure that out for themselves, that, you know, that the Jewish youth are not being affected by the kind of stuff that they are putting forth, which is entirely meant to infect Gentile youth. I don't know if that's true.
Well, he admits that some of the Jews are affected by it. The poison that they put out. I think it's probably more today than it was at the time, since religious Judaism is probably on the wane.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they've been as successful at insulating their people from the effects of their own poison.
Well, there shows, you're saying right there, that religion does is a way to resist this poison.
Well, sure.
And this looseness. Yeah.
Well, sure, but you know, they had some I don't remember if it was a I think it was a song contest or some kind of song performance contest winner from that represented the state of Israel that was like a transsexual or something a few years ago.
Yeah, well, that's the
a lot of weird stuff goes on among Jews these days.
Oh yeah. Well, you're right. Well, they're just basically that way anyway.
You know,
they're
Larry
kind of an immoral people.
Larry Birkin over in San Francisco that got arrested last week.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to talk about that on a program, but I didn't get to it.
Yeah.
That's a great story, though.
Yeah. Apparently, he had not just child pornography, but infant pornography.
It's just really something. What they need in order
it's
to get
gay
to
rights
themselves a charge. Yeah, gay rights. Well, he's homosexual. Well, let's go on. Maybe we can talk about that.
All right. So they are affected by that stuff.
Yeah.
Many a father and mother, many a sound-minded, uncorrupted young person, and thousands of teachers and publicists have cried out against luxury. Many a financier, observing the manner in which the people earned and flung away their money, has warned against luxury. Many an economist, knowing that the non-essential industries were consuming men and materials that were necessary to the stabilizing of essential industries, knowing that men are making knickknacks who should be making steel, knowing that men are engaged in making gewgaws who should be working on the farm, that materials are going into articles that are made only to sell and never to use, and that materials are thus diverted from the industries that support the people's life, every observer knowing this crazy insistence on luxurious non-essentials has lifted up a strong voice against it.
Well, I think that's just great. You know, I'm a very thrifty person, and that kind of thing speaks to me. All this waste, I thought, along with so many other people, as we became aware that in our world we were having more and more wasteful products and more products that you're supposed to throw away after a few years when they didn't work anymore. They weren't supposed to last, and you weren't supposed to fix them. Cost more to repair them, to buy a new one and stuff like that. You know, everything just changed like that. Everything became, and what's terrible is that white people, millions and millions of them, love creepy little knickknacks and, figure, you know, little stuff that they buy in gift shops and so on, mm-hmm. on trips and travel, you know, ashtrays or any kind of millions of things that they get to remind them, and they like that stuff. So what are you going to do? You know? Okay. Well,
I mean, it also includes stuff like tobacco, really. Tobacco,
yes.
Tobacco is useless. That's the Third Reich, they tried to discourage the use of tobacco. One of the reasons was because Germany didn't grow tobacco, and it was it hurt the trade balance.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought of that.
You know, all this stuff that's unnecessary draws.
Well, yeah, I like what he says here. Non-essential industries, that fits like in with the tobacco, were consuming materials that were necessary to the stabilizing of essential industries. Things like that, you're right. And that's just where the Jews would try to screw up the country by not wanting to follow that kind of thinking and using up resources for stuff that was. Wait, there had no purpose.
Right.
Yeah.
But according to these protocols, we have been starting at the wrong end. The people, it is true, buy these senseless non-essentials, which are called luxuries, but the people do not devise them. And the people grow tired of them one by one. But the stream of varieties continues, always something else being thrust at the people, dangled before their eyes, set bobbing down the avenue on enough mannequins to give the impression that it is style. Newspaper print and newspaper pictures. Moving pictures. Stage costumes enough to force the new thing into fashion with a kind of force and compulsion which no really worthy essential thing can demand.
Command. Yeah, you know, now here again, this, most of these... I bet you could find that at least a large number of these little manufacturing companies that make these gewgaws and non-essential knickknacks and things are owned by Jews. Mm-hmm. Most Christian white people, businessmen, they were into more serious, you know, serious industries at one time. The Jews have taken over those too, I guess. But the Jews would start up all this junk stuff. And they knew how to make it sell. It's the same thing they've been doing forever in their trade, selling old rags and, you know, selling junk, selling stuff, whatever they could sell, they were good at selling it. Makes me think of Maxwell Street in Chicago.
It reminds me of the story about Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, who came up with the idea of getting people, using psychology, to get people to buy things not because they needed them but because they wanted them. You give them an idea that that this is something not that they need but that would be cool to have.
Well, yeah, and that's the fashion with the kind of force and compulsion. That's how they do it, you know, with magazines and making people see beautiful pictures of things. And I used to get taken in by that. I didn't. You know, I thought, oh, I should look like this, I should have these things, I should buy these things. But I didn't really do it most of the time. It never lasted with me. But you know, I'd get very affected by it. And I know how young women do, and girls and little girls and everything are all brainwashed by that kind of thing, by what's in these magazines.
And you know, one of the most famous advertising campaigns, and an early one that Bernays did, was for tobacco. It was to get women to smoke.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and yeah. I think Ford mentions earlier here that the Jews are heavily involved in some stage of the tobacco trade.
No, that's right. Everything that's a vice, everything that becomes addictive, everything like that, Dave. It's true. It's absolutely true. And that's why it's important for people to, even though this stuff is kind of old and a little bit dated, I think it's very interesting, and it does teach us better than some of the newer things that are written.
Where does it come from? What power exists whose long experience and deliberate intent enable it to frivolize the people's minds and tastes and compel them to pay most of their money for it, too? Why this spasm of luxury and extravagance through which we have just passed? How did it occur that before luxury and extravagance were apparent, all the material to provoke and inflame them had been prepared beforehand and shipped beforehand, ready for the stampede which also had been prepared? If the people of the United States would stop to consider when the useless and expensive thing is offered to them, if they would trace its origin, trace the course of the enormous profits made out of it, trace the whole movement to flood the market with uselessness and extravagance and thus demoralize the Gentile public financially, intellectually, and socially. If, in short, it could be made clear to them that Jewish financial interests are not only pandering to the loosest elements in human nature, but actually engaged in a calculated effort to render them loose in the first place, and keep them loose, it would do more than anything else to stop this sixfold waste. The waste of material, the waste of labor, the waste of Gentile money, the waste of Gentile mind, the waste of Jewish talent, and the worse than waste of Israel's real usefulness to the world.
Well, the last two, there again, they're trying to show that they would like, they're trying to do something constructive here and get the Jews involved in more constructive pursuits. But that's never going to happen. We know that now. I mean,
you people of the Bible are too good to be doing this. Why are you doing this?
Okay, but you know, this is, you know, if we think that, if they thought that there was waste going on then, that was nothing compared to the waste we have now.
Probably.
Look at the waste that we are all, and we don't, it goes on in front of our face and we don't do anything about it. I mean, this trillion, multi-trillion dollar national deficits and stuff, and this huge money being thrown around and these bailouts and all this stuff, bigger than that we were ever told they were, and just incredible waste. Even in Europe, all that money that the European Union is insisting that one country send to another country, you know, the wealthier countries send to the poorer countries, it just goes on and gets more and more and more. I mean, this is, you know, but you have to start in looking at waste in your own life and changing your life. I love to get to not waste things. I love to, you know, make things last and make things usable and so on. At least we have recycling nowadays. That seems to be a good thing. But I like that paragraph very much.
I think Jews are heavily involved in recycling too.
Well, they are involved in everything where they can make a buck.
I mean, they
run everything.
That was something that Ford said early in the International Jew, something about how the Jew is the one that found out, concentrated on turning waste products into something profitable.
Oh, well, yeah, that. Well, they might be too, because they're manufacturing all this junk and selling it, and then they know it's accumulating and people won't like that, so they come up with recycling to get rid of it. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. Oh, and meanwhile charging the cities for the recycling, I think.
That's right. Somebody's paying for it.
We say the Gentile public is the victim of this stimulated trade in useless luxuries. Did you ever see Jewish people so victimized? They might wear very noticeable clothing, but its price and its quality agree. They might wear rather large diamonds, but they are diamonds. The Jew is not the victim of the Jew. The craze for luxuries is just like the Coney Island crowd to him. He knows what attracts them and the worthlessness of it. And it is not so much the financial loss that is to be mourned, nor yet the atrocities committed upon good taste, but the fact that the silly Gentile crowds walk into the net willingly, even gaily, supposing the change of the fashion to be as inevitable as the coming of spring, supposing the new demand on their earnings to be as necessary and as natural as taxes. The crowds think that somehow they have part in it, when their only part is to pay, and then pay again for the new extravagance when the present one palls. There are men in this country who know 2 years ahead what the frivolities and extravagances of the people will be, because they decree what they shall be. These things are all strictly business, demoralizing to the Gentile majority, enriching to the Jewish minority. Look at the sixth protocol for a sidelight on all this. This is an excerpt.
Oh, no, you go ahead. Sorry.
False cue there. This is an excerpt from a longer passage dealing with the plans by which the people's interest could be swung from political to industrial questions. How industry could be made insecure and unfair by the introduction of speculation into its management. And finally, how against this condition the people could be rendered restless and helpless. Luxury was to be the instrument.
To destroy Gentile industry, we shall, as an incentive to this speculation, encourage among the Gentiles a strong demand for luxury. Luxuries. All enticing luxuries.
And in the first protocol.
Surely, we cannot allow our own people to come to this. The people of the Gentiles are stupefied with spirituous liquors.
Incidentally, the profits of spirituous liquors flow in large amounts to Jewish pockets. The history of the whiskey ring in this country will show this. Historically, the whole prohibition movement may be described as a contest between Gentile and Jewish capital, and in this instance, thanks to the Gentile majority, the Gentiles won. The amusement, gambling, jazz song, scarlet fiction, sideshow, cheap deer fashions, flashy jewelry, and every other activity that lived by reason of an invisible pressure upon the people, and that exchanged the most useless of commodities for the prices that would just exhaust the people's money surplus and no more. Every such activity has been under the mastery of the Jews. They may not be conscious of their participation in any wholesale demoralization of the people. They may only be conscious of easy money. They may sometimes yield to surprise as they contrast the silly Gentiles with their own money-wise and fabric-wise and metal-wise Jews. But however this may be, there is the conception of a program by which a people may be deliberately devastated materially and spiritually, and yet kept pleasant all the time. And there also is the same program translated into terms of daily transactions and, for the most part, perhaps altogether under control of the members of the same race, of one race.
Well, that's the end of that chapter. What do you say about that, Hanning?
He's saying that maybe they're all just doing what they do because that's the way they are, and they're just doing things that work for them. But on the other hand, it could be an overarching, conscious, deliberate plan.
And this easy money thing, you know. Well, I don't know who he's talking to about that. He's talking about the Jews, but Gentiles, we all fall into that love of easy money. We get fascinated if some opportunity comes along, and it seems as though it's going to be easy money. Who resists that? Not hardly anybody.
Well,
till you've been burned.
They have a lot more opportunities for easy money than we have because of their conspiratorial tendencies. you know, with that, they can do insider trading and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm always thinking about much smaller stuff, little stuff that comes a little
ordinary. I got a tip from my cousin.
Yeah, not Moshe. That kind of thing. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, that's true. But even just
set
in
an army base, and what we'd do is buy the land all around it and set up, sex novelty shops.
Yeah, it's this kind of thing. You know, it's easy money where.
When Ford set up a plant in Brazil, a rubber plant, where they were going to make rubber for tires, mm-hmm. that actually happened. The Jews set up corrupting enterprises near his little factory town.
Gosh. Well, there's so much. We could pull up so many good examples for this, but we won't. And you know, we're halfway through the program, and now we're ready to start our second chapter 13. So that's pretty good timing.
Jewish plan to split society by ideas. That's in quotes, ideas. That's chapter 13. The method by which the protocols work for the breakdown of society. Okay, I have a problem with this first sentence here because this is unfortunate wording, and it shows a way in which the focus of the international Jew has gone, I think, a little bit awry. He says, the method by which the protocols work for the breakdown of society.
Well, look, these chapters are looking at the protocol. So that's what they're describing. They're describing what's in the method that's used in the protocols.
Except that we don't
they're
know
not saying. Protocols. Well, I know, but they're not saying that one way or the other. They're just
we don't
saying,
know that anybody is using this as a plan.
Well, you worry about that too much.
We know that you worry. Because it says here the protocols are doing something. The protocols are not doing it.
They're saying the method by which the protocols work. Well, that's just a way of saying, okay, unfortunate wording to you. You don't like that wording. But what they mean, you know, is that this is what you find in the protocols. This is how the protocols say it's going to work, say they're working. The protocols say this is what we're doing. This is how we're doing it. So they are saying that this method that they've been describing in the last few chapters should now be fairly evident to the readers of these articles.
All right, I can read that. The method by which the protocols work for the breakdown... I just wanted to point out that I objected to the direction that he was going. Mm-hmm. The method by which the protocols work for the breakdown of society should now be fairly evident to readers of these articles. An understanding of the method is necessary if one is to find the meaning of the currents and cross-currents which make so hopeless a hodgepodge of the present times. People who are confused and discouraged by the various voices and discordant theories of today, each seeming to be plausible and promising, may find a clear cue to the value of the voices and the meaning of the theories if they understand that their confusion and discouragement comprise the very objective which is sought.
Mm-hmm.
The uncertainty, hesitation, hopelessness, fear, the eagerness with which every promising plan and offered solution is grasped, these are the very reactions which the program outlined in the protocols claims to produce.
Aims
to produce. The condition is proof of the efficacy of the program.
This is important, I say, and I have to look, see why I thought it was important. But, people, discouragement, uncertainty, hopeless. Well, this is important because this is what we talk about in our very times, that there's all this uncertainty. Well, there is definitely uncertainty. Just talking about money, as you were mentioning before. There is not even any certainty in how to invest money or how to save money or how to use money, you know, because it's also, it can all come apart at the drop of the hat, and it has. So, and then there's hesitation, there's hopelessness, There's fear about all this is this is to produce whatever it's going to produce, confusion. And so we see it, right? And they saw it then, and we see it now. But that doesn't mean...
Jews are heavily involved in things like multiculturalism, stuff like that, which tends to, which certainly tends to break down society and create confusion. I mean, they introduce a lot of stuff into education that really seems to be designed to confuse and demoralize people.
Yes, right. Okay. Oh, some idiots.
It is a method that takes time, and the protocols declare that it has taken time, indeed centuries. Students of the matter find the identical program of the protocols announced and operated by the Jewish race from its first century onward.
So they're saying that this started, you know, in the time of Christ.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the evidence is for that as a continuous program.
No, but that's what he's saying. That's what the International Jew is saying. That's it. Just, you know, from the first century, they mean, you know, from then. You know, when the Jews first, I guess, had something to dislike.
Well, either that, unless Christianity is the conspiracy.
Yeah.
It has taken.
They don't believe that.
What?
Of course, they don't believe that. The writers here.
Well, that's not what they're saying here.
No.
It has taken 1,900 years to bring Europe to its present degree of subjugation. Violent subjugation in some countries, political subjugation in some, economic subjugation in all. But in America, the same program, with almost the same degree of success, has required about 50 years. Certain mistaken ideas of liberalism, certain flabby ideas of tolerance, all of them originated at European sources, which the protocolists had completely polluted, were transported to America. And here, under cover of the blindness and innocence of a false liberalism and tolerance, together with modern appliances for the swift acceleration of opinion, that would be mass media, there has been worked a subjugation of our institutions and public thought, which is the amazement of European observers. It is a fact that some of the most important students, some of the important students of the Jewish question, whom Jewish publicists are pleased to damn with the term anti-Semites, have been awakened to the existence of the question not by what they have observed in Europe, but by what they have seen in the swift and distinct... Oh, crap.
Something got in your way? A swift and distinct...
I hit the wrong button here, but I think I'm...
Close-up?
Yes, I'm back where I was now.
Okay.
It is a fact that some of the important students of the Jewish question, whom Jewish publicists are pleased to damn with the term anti-Semites, have been awakened to the existence of the question, not by what they have observed in Europe, but by what they have seen in the swift and distinct close-up which has been afforded in American affairs.
Here they use... liberalism and tolerance, intolerance and liberalism, twice. You know, I was talking a while back about Barack Obama's speech where he was combining tolerance with violence, and he used that twice in his speech. But they're using it more correctly. Liberalism and tolerance go together. And that this took place, this has been brought into America so quickly. You know, it's been going on. The Europeans were actually fighting it for a couple hundred years, you know, I mean, a couple thousand years off and on and dealing with the Jews and so on. But in America, it just took hold immediately.
Well, I don't think the Europeans were dealing with Jews for quite a few centuries there very much. Jews were they were largely centered within Islamic civilization for a long time.
Well, in medieval times, but early medieval times, if you read, well, I'm sure you have, Alfred Rosenberg's stuff on the Jews. He takes it pretty far back, and a lot of people do. They take it very far back. But it's not like it was everywhere. But still, like I say, you know, the Jews had a harder time back then getting a hold, but they don't have a hard time now.
Yeah. The Center of Jewish Power, the principal sponsors of the Jewish program, are resident in America. And the leverage which was used at the peace conference to fasten Jewish power more securely upon Europe was American leverage exercised at the behest of the strong Jewish pressure which was brought from the United States for that purpose. And these activities did not end with the peace conference.
Yeah, there's the peace conference again.
I was just pointing out here that the Jews had a whole lot more power in the United States than they had in Germany when the National Socialists came to power and took what the power that the Jews had away from them. But the fact that the Jews had this power in the United States ended up being the undoing of Germany.
Yeah, that's right. That's a real good topic to go into for someone.
The whole method of the protocols may be described in one word, disintegration. The undoing of what has been done, the creation of a long and hopeless interim in which attempts at reconstruction shall be baffled, and the gradual wearing down of public opinion and public confidence, until those who stand outside the created chaos shall insert their strong, calm hand to seize control. That is the whole method of procedure.
Okay, we got that. They're gonna bring disintegration in our society by undoing things, gradually wearing down of people and their confidence and their beliefs and opinions. And then when all kinds of chaos is created, then they shall take control.
I'm not sure that I agree with that. That matches what happened in the Soviet Union, in Russia, where there was chaos, and then the Bolsheviks, whose main figures were Jews, took over. But that's a pattern that has occurred in history before. When you have chaos, there's a tendency for some dictator to come to power. And in Russia, it just happened to be that Jews, some organized faction of Jews, seized the opportunity.
Just happened, huh?
Well,
they just happened to be there. Yeah,
they were there, and there was a Russian general that tried to do that, but he was blocked by the fact that Jews controlled the railways and telegraphs.
Well, they think of everything. They're always well prepared. Okay, but.
But what I was going to say is that Jews actually, see what happened in the Soviet Union, you have this faction, the Bolsheviks, that takes over. At that point, they're responsible for what happens in the country, and they have to try to make things work. They actually have to try to make things work. And it ended up that Stalin was the one that came in and actually got things working to some extent.
Well, I don't think they made things work very well. They didn't care how the people were suffering. They didn't make things work very well. What they did was force all the poor people in to take what the wealthy people had and move into their homes and so on, and then just kept pushing the political element to have so much power that the people were just intimidated and couldn't fight against them. So the political element was in control. And it was just it was horrible there. Horrible.
Well, see, this is a criticism that you'll see in some Jewish conservative writers. Is that once a powerful government is established, even if it's established by Jews, there's no guarantee that it's going to be remain in the control of Jews, because the nature of a totalitarian government is that it is responsible for what happens in the country. It yeah. has to do some things that make sense, and it has to maintain some degree of order. This is not to the advantage of the Jewish way of life, because yeah. they depend on disorder to do their manipulations and their exploitations.
Well, I don't know. They've done plenty of manipulation and exploitations in orderly Christian European societies.
Because those are liberal societies.
No, they weren't. They were just ordinary back in the Middle Ages and so on. But they were doing their stuff then. They took advantage of all this. They managed to do their usury and take advantage of the people and get richer and richer.
On a small scale.
The church
kept that kind of stuff contained pretty
much. Yeah, it was a small scale, but they were still doing it. And this is, that's just the way that they operate. It's the way they operate. You're right. So they don't have to have disorder. They can do their thing in an orderly society, too. They just wanted, at that time, they wanted revolution. They wanted a world revolution. They were connected in with communism. I would say not all Jews were part of that. And a lot of the Jews, they're just making money. And they just learn how to make money no matter what's going on. So if it's revolutionary times, they make money. And if it's, conservative times, they make money.
Most of the Jews in Russia were Mensheviks and supported going along with the orthodox Marxist scheme of how history was supposed to unfold, which would have kept the disorder going on for quite a long time. That's where most of the Jews were politically. And the Bolsheviks took a different path, which ended up taking control of the situation arguably out of the Jews' hands, at least it wasn't entirely in the Jews' hands at that point, because Stalin took a lot of the Jews out of the government. Anyway.
Well, one thing they did there was they did take control of collective opinion, which is what's coming up here. So I'd say that was going on in the Soviet Union, in the Bolshevik Revolution and so on. So let's read about the collective opinion.
Putting together the estimate of human nature which obtains in these protocols and their claims to a rather definite, though as yet incomplete, fulfillment of the world program, these two comprising the themes of the previous two articles, some of the aspects of this propaganda of disintegration have become clear, but not all of them. There are yet other aspects of these methods which will be dealt within the present article, and there are yet future reaches of the program which will be considered later. The first point of attack is collective opinion, that body of ideas which, through men's agreement with them, holds large groups together in political, racial, religious, or social unity. Sometimes we call them standards, sometimes we call them ideals. Whatever they may be called, they are the invisible bonds of unity. They are the common faith. They are the great overarching reason for group unity and loyalty. The protocols assert that here the first attack has been made. The history of Jewish propaganda in the world shows that also. The first wave of attack is to corrupt collective opinion. Now, to corrupt, in the real sense, does not mean anything unsavory or unclean. The whole power of every heresy is its attractiveness to the good mind. The whole explanation of the strong hold which untruth has gained upon the world of our day is that the untruth is reasonable, inspiring, and apparently good.
That's really important, you know. That's really important for people to listen to, that when they corrupt things, they make it seem to us that it is reasonable, inspiring, and good, and they're going to point that out. I'm going to go turn off that phone, so keep reading.
It is only after a long discipline in false ideals, which are reasonable, inspiring, and good, that the evil fruits appear in acts and conditions which are unreasonable, destructive, and wholly evil. If you will trace the idea of liberty as it has appeared in Russian history from its philosophic beginning, a Jewish beginning, by the way, to its present ending, a Jewish ending also, you will see the process. The protocols claim that the Gentiles are not thinkers, that attractive ideas have been thrown at them so strategically and persistently that the power of thought is almost destroyed out of them. Fortunately, this is a matter on which any Gentile may apply his own test. If he will segregate his ruling ideas, especially those that center around the thought of democracy, he will discover that he is being ruled in his mind by a whole company of ideas into whose authority over him he has not inquired at all. He is ruled by say-so, whose origin he has not traced. And when pursuing those ideas he finds that they are not practicable, he is received by the explanation that we are not sufficiently advanced. Yet when he does see men who are sufficiently advanced to put these very ideas into operation, he recoils from what he sees them do, because he knows that advancement such as that is deterioration, a form of disintegration.
Now, this I think is talking about Freemasonry, you know, or that's part of what they could be talking about.
No,
Freemasonry, sure, they were pushing democracy, and the idea, I don't mean Freemasonry per se, but you know what, these people who are, when you bring forth these ideas, but when that say, and then they say, well, you are not sufficiently advanced yet to understand this. If you question it, you know, people, he said that they look at these things, and when you look at it being done, you say, hey, this is not a good idea. But they say, oh, well, you're just not sufficiently advanced yet to understand it. And this sounds very much like Freemasonry. Anyway. And you know, he was a Freemason, and maybe he wasn't all that sold on it. Even though he maybe, I don't know that he ever left it. It's probably kind of hard to do. But I don't know that he was all sold on it. This may be an example of that. And then these men were writing this. This was not really written. You don't see any. Well, I do. Keep going.
Yet every one of the ideas were good, reasonable, inspiring, humane to begin with. And if this Gentile will observe a little further, he will see that they are the most persistently preached ideas in the world. He will also see who the preachers are.
Mm-hmm.
The protocols distinctly
declare.
No, then
he says, what are some of these ideas? They have that sentence. What are some of these ideas? Don't they?
No.
Did I write that? Oh, I wrote that. I didn't put. Okay, I wrote
well,
that.
You didn't write it in my copy, so I don't have it.
No, that's right. And I said, what are some of these ideas? Okay, equality. Democracy, I'm just saying these might be some of them. Diversity, free trade, I'm getting kind of modern here. Open borders, good neighbors. These are all things that sound, have that sound of being good. And what were that? What were those three words he used? Inspiring and something else. You know, truthful.
Yeah, you mean.
But we've learned about all of these things that they have bad results. They're not good. Not even good neighbors. You know, if you're going to assume that, you have to be a good neighbor and consider your neighbors good neighbors and blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
Well, if you get people who are basically benevolent to assume that everybody else is benevolent as they are, from that assumption, they can be persuaded to do all kinds of foolish things.
Well, yes.
Yes,
but I think we can go even further. This is some these are actual beliefs promulgated by the Jews through things that make it sound like they're really high level ideas. And what could fit that better than these ideas in Freemasonic lodges? I think it's a good guess. But anyway, go ahead. This thrust goes with it.
The protocols distinctly declare that it is by means of the set of ideas which cluster around democracy that their first victory over public opinion was obtained. The idea is the weapon. And to be a weapon, it must be an idea at variance with the natural trend of life. It must be a theory opposed to the facts of life. And that actually is a kind of observation that Friedrich Nietzsche made.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
About how democracy and equality and all this cuts off the roots of life.
Okay.
And no theory so opposed can be expected to take root and become the ruling factor unless it appeals to the mind as reasonable, inspiring, and good. The truth frequently seems unreasonable. The truth frequently is depressing. The truth sometimes seems to be evil, but it has this eternal advantage. It is the truth, and what is built thereon neither brings nor yields to confusion.
Now, that is really good writing. They really came up with something good there. And yes. When they use the word reason, where is it again? Where are those three things? Reasonable, inspiring, and good. Well, that's another thing with Freemasonry. You pointed that out yourself, that it wants to think about things according to reason, wants to bring into effect reason instead of blind faith of religions. And you know, they make it seem that way. And that's where all these people join.
Well,
I'm just saying that's the way I think you could, you know, I sort of put that in there. That doesn't mean it's the only thing that fits there. But it's so good. You were going to say something, but it's so good when they say the truth often seems unreasonable. It can be depressing, and it can even seem evil. And there's a lot of truth that seems evil, just like in the area of genetics. I mean, eugenics that, or maybe even genetics. I mean, you know, people have these ideas, and they've been told that this, that, the other thing is evil. And so then they can't go there, and that's where they'd find some truth.
Well, you see, the thing is, if you're really getting at the truth, at objective fact, and not trying to BS people, as some people like to do, or try to make use of the whatever lies are current and that people already believe, if you're not playing that kind of rhetorical game, then precisely as it says here, you find it much more possible to avoid confusion and to achieve unity, because you have this solid reference point of objective reality. It's real. It's there. You can bring people to it.
Okay. Very good. Well, you know, we're out of time, and so we are going to start up. We may spend the next week on this chapter, because there's quite a lot of it left, and then we would be able to start on a new chapter at the beginning of a program. So this is this is chapter 13 we're on, isn't it? Boy, I just moved up, went way up. And then we would be finished 13 next week. It's a lot of interesting stuff in this one, don't you think?
Yeah.
Okay, well, good night, Hattie.
Well, good night.
And good night, folks. We'll see you next week. Hope you enjoyed it.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.